This podcast is produced in part by Podfly.net. Podfly, passion for great sounding podcasts.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
Coming up on Columbia Calling with me, your host Richard McCall, we're going to be talking all things Columbia with an author of the Lonely Planet Guide Columbia, Alex Edgerton. So we're sitting down with Australian-born Alex Edgerton, the author of the Columbia Lonely Planet Guide book, to talk about travel and all things Columbia. Don't miss out.
The world is a beautiful place, so listen up. The Overseas Radio Network.
We know you want to grow your business and directly engage your customers and clientele. Podcasting is the way to go, and Podfly has your solution. Whether you're a blogger, writer, business owner, entrepreneur, or service provider, Podfly makes it easy for anyone to have a professionally produced and distributed podcast. Get started today at podfly.net, and let's get your message truly heard. Podfly.net, passion for great-sounding podcasts.
Ready to learn about a new life overseas? You're at the right place. This is the Overseas Radio Network.
It's that time of the week again, folks, and it's me, your host, Richard McCall, here for Columbia Calling on the Overseas Radio Network. We've got a great show ahead of us today. We're going to be talking to Alex Edgerton, one of the authors of The Lonely Planet Guide to Columbia. Of course, that's the best-selling guidebook to Columbia, and it's obviously a worldwide renowned editorial house there for travel guides and so on. So very happy to get the time to talk to Alex Edgerton and discuss with him all things Colombian. And now, so we're here in Bogota, 2,600 meters above sea level, and the correct weather has finally come about. I was getting a bit unnerved. It was becoming too nice here in Bogota with the sun. We were getting sunsets. I mean, the sun was lasting from morning all the way to the night. And you heard it here first, folks. There were Bogotanos in shorts in the park at nighttime. Yeah, I saw it with my very own eyes. So it wasn't backpackers and they weren't foreigners. They were Bogotanos in shorts. So that fashion faux pas, ordinary fashion faux pas, was actually not foreigners this time, but it was Bogotanos because it was hot. I mean, I'm not the first person to say it was hot here in Bogota. World Cup frenzy has taken the streets here. I've never seen anything like it. And the sticker album, the Panini sticker album, was released last Sunday in the El Tiempo newspaper, and then it's available for sale. And I've never seen El Tiempo sell out so fast. And as everyone went out to buy it to have their sticker album, and it's not just, you know, kids in school. Adults are out there, and now there's this whole sort of, let's say, I've never seen Colombians so organized. I mean, they seem to be the most organized people in the world when it comes to trading stickers for the World Cup. There are people set up on the corners, grown men trading, and, you know, everything is a business here. So you've got these, you know, people who would usually be selling, sort of, let's say, chicles, chewing gum or incense on the corners are there now trading stickers for a fee. So instead of having to write to Panini in the end when you can't get those final 30 stickers, you just walk down to the corner outside of your supermarket or wherever they're stationed. They're all over the place. They've got, you know, the telltale World Cup sticker boxes in front of them, and they will there, you know, quote you a price for the stickers that you need. So therefore, you know, the problem is solved. And God, if you really want some fun, go and head out to the forecourts of any of the universities here, in particular in Bogota, La Javeriana, which is around the 45th on Septima, or Los Andes, and everybody is trading stickers there. So World Cup fever is well and truly in flow here, well and truly in flow. Before I get on to further announcements, I just want to share with you, a couple of weeks ago we interviewed a young man by the name of Kai Whiting. He approached Columbia Calling to be interviewed because, of course, his is an interesting story. He's a white British Muslim here in Columbia, so we get to talk to him about his religion and, you know, if he'd ever felt any discrimination, for his faith. Now, perhaps one thing that wasn't mentioned is that Kai walks with a slight limp, and, well, he got in touch the other day because he felt he had been discriminated against here in Bogota, not for his faith, but for his limp. It so turned out that he was in an amusement park, a very well-known, very famous amusement park here in Bogota, and upon seeing his limp, he was then barred from entering any of the rides. And then, fair enough, he asked for his money back and to leave, and at the end, they decided they wouldn't give it to him. So, I mean, I would say that's discrimination and, of course, you know, bad business practice. So we're giving a shout-out of solidarity to Kai on the show here, and hopefully he can resolve this situation, and we as a country and as a people can move forward to being more tolerant. And we're not talking about being seriously disabled. Kai rides a bike, and he's lived in four continents, and I mean, he's been all over the place. I'm sure he treks as well. It's a mild limp, but having been spotted with his limp, he was then discriminated against and barred from all of the rides. Big news, really, that hit the headlines this last week, of course, was Gabriel Garcia Marquez being hospitalized. Within moments of that news coming out, it really became a headline, the front page. The Telegraph carried it, and the UK and The Guardian, both on their front pages. And here, even Juan Manuel Santos, got onto his Twitter account and, on behalf of all Colombians, wished him well. Well, thank you, Juan Manuel. Thank you, Mr. President, on my behalf, for wishing Gallo well. Anyway, it seems that he was the Nobel Prize-winning author, 100 Years of Solitude, Love in the Time of Cholera, Nobody Writes the Colonel, any number of books in journalism that you can think of. Really, the widest-selling author in the Spanish language, only outsold by the Bible here in Latin America. So, yes, we wish him well, too, on Columbia Calling, but we found out he was a mild pulmonary, and so lung infection, and a mild urinary tract infection. The gentleman is 87 years old. It's not been publicly confirmed that he's suffering from dementia, but we have it on good sources that he is also suffering from dementia. So he's an old man, 87 years old. And don't forget, in 1999, he also suffered treatment for lymphatic cancer. So, he's rolling with the punches. So he was hospitalized there in Mexico, and we wish him all the best. I think he'll be released on Monday or on Tuesday. What else going on? Well, Columbia Reports, I know I owe them a mention, because Columbia Reports, Adrian Aselma, who was one of the first people interviewed on this show back in July or August last year, they're releasing a book on everything you need to know about Columbia and investing in Columbia. I believe it's called Invest in Columbia. So if you're interested in coming to Columbia, if you're interested in doing business here, check it out. It's now a crowdsourcing, it's going to be crowdfunded. That's it. That's a crowdfunding. I believe it's on Indiegogo. But you'll find all sorts of links on their websites. That's columbiareports.com. So if you're interested in that, check it out. We're going to be right back with Alex Edgerton of The Lonely Planet talking all things Columbia. Keep looking for us online. That's columbiacallingradio.com, and find me on Twitter. That's Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall, and we'll be right back.
OverseasRadio.com, broadcasting from Panama to Paris and beyond.
You've got questions about Columbia, and Escape Artist has answers. Is Columbia a good fit for me and my plans? How do I buy a house? Find a job? Find a doctor? Start a business? Invest in real estate? What should I know to better appreciate its history, its culture, its opportunities? What is it really like to be an expat in Colombia? You'll find your answers at columbia.escapeartist.com, your complete and trusted guide for living, working, playing, investing, and retiring in Colombia. That's columbia.escapeartist.com.
You're listening to the Overseas Radio Network, the exclusive online radio station for the expatriate community.
And we're back. This is Richard McCall, and you're listening to Columbia Calling. And this week I'm talking to an author, well, you know, a best-selling author, really, because he's the author of The Lonely Planet Guide to Columbia, so that's why we've got him on the show. But Alex Edgerton, a Australian native, has been here in Columbia for some time. He's going to tell us about his time here in Columbia. And, of course, he's written other books, other Lonely Planet guidebooks about the region. So welcome on the show, Alex.
Thanks, Richard.
The background noise here, we're sitting in a tea shop recording, so it will just sound very familiar to any of you out there. But so, Alex, which of the other Lonely Planet books have you written?
I've worked in Central America and South America, but mainly Nicaragua, which I lived in Nicaragua for quite a while, from around 2004. Till about 2011, and Colombia, and then the Central America book and the South America book. So those are my areas of, I guess, expertise. But, you know, I also work writing newspaper articles, magazine articles about the whole region. So it depends, you know, wherever something's happening, I'm willing to go and give a look and, you know, write something and see if we can get the message out.
So we're talking to someone who's, you know, incredibly knowledgeable in the region. So this is why this is going to be a very sort of free-rein interview, because we're going to talk about, you know, no holds barred, Colombia, travel, and so on and so forth. But, you know, The Lonely Planet obviously is the most sort of, it's the most purchased book when people come to Colombia. Is that just because of the brand, would you say, or the quality, or...
I think with Colombia, I mean, in the Colombia book, we're three authors. I work with a couple of other, because it's a big country, so we split it up to try and get as much detail into the book as possible, which means that we're able to spend more time on the ground, which helps us compared to, maybe because it's a bigger company, it has more resources to get more authors on the ground for a longer time. I think that helps. I think originally, the Colombia book, there was a book written, the original Colombia book was written by an author, Christoph, a Polish author, back in the day, and that was absolutely amazing. He did the whole job on his own and went to all corners of the country. And even now, that original book is a great resource because he went to places that, after he visited, maybe became off limits for a while. And even now, as they're starting to become accessible again, his information is pretty much the only information available to some of these places. So that was a good base. I think one of the most important things in a place like Colombia is really getting on the ground, because things change really fast. And so, you know, getting the book updated, getting on all the buses to all the remote destinations. Sometimes we'll go, you know, to far places, spend a day on a bus to get there, spend 2 days researching it, and decide not even to include it. Because, you know, that's the kind of detail you have to get into to make sure that it's a useful product. I think the one thing, I mean, there's a lot of good books out there. They've all got their you know, I know you're an author, Richard, they've all got their their benefits. But I think one thing is, yeah, that getting that level of detail in your research, because there's no way your end products can be as useful to the traveler unless you've done those hard yards.
Okay, well, it's good to hear, and it's really good to have you on the show, because having a Lonely Planet author, you know, does give me some gravitas, of course, you know, the fact that I've got you here, managed to pin you down, because I know you live in the southern city of Popayan. At the moment, you've moved around a bit. How is Popayan as a base?
Well, compared, it's, you know, quality of life, it's fantastic. It's a very small town. You know, I never get in a bus or a taxi or a bicycle. I walk. You know, I'm 3 or 4 blocks from the centre. I can rent a house, an affordable house. You know, if you have things to do in the day, you spend 10, 20, 30 minutes, you go to the bank, you go to the mayor's office, whatever you have to do, and you're back home and working. Whereas in Bogota or Medellin, you know, any mission is 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. So, you know, quality of life's good. It's a little bit isolated, but that helps as well, because it means the area is very... There's not a lot of tourist infrastructure, you know. There's a lot of towns around Popayan that are very easy to visit with, you know, we've got thermal springs, we've got the Pudasay National Park, we've got some fantastic mountain ranges, you know, beautiful scenery. It's very diverse, but it's all to be done. Popayan's still the focus. I mean, within Colombia, it's famous for its architecture. It's one of the most well-preserved colonial towns, but you know, the area around it is really undiscovered, so that's one of the reasons I enjoy being there, is to venture out and see these places, these communities. It also, Kalka Department is one of the most diverse departments in the country ethnically. There's Afro-descendant populations on the coastline, and then as you go up into the mountain, there's a lot of indigenous communities that are quite well organized. So it's a very interesting place to be. Has a bit of a tough reputation, but you know, Popayán itself is a very safe and
very
relaxed
calm
place. Yeah, it's very calm.
As well.
Yeah,
it's
got a lot of universities. Yeah. People come from all over the south of Colombia, which is great because you get to meet people and get to go to their towns and, you know, see another side of the country.
I mean, you talk about Cauca and the diversity as well. It's a little known fact, you probably know, but in the town of Corinto, Cauca was the Japanese, that was their major settlement prior to World War II.
Yes.
Now they've all gone. But
yeah, there's not a lot of relics left from that, but Corinto is now quite a hot spot.
Yeah.
So it's not big on the tourist trail.
No.
But all these little towns have a lot of history. I mean, Cauca was one of the first places after obviously the initial colonization of Colombia. It was one of the first places when the Spanish moved up from Ecuador.
Yeah.
And Popayán is an ancient city. I mean, it's been there a long time. It's still got that feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very traditional. It's a very conservative place.
Yes.
The pioneers, the inhabitants of Popayán are quite different to the inhabitants of the surrounding region of Cauca. They're of Spanish origin, and they see themselves more or less as quite, without meaning to, as a little bit perhaps apart from the rest of the population of the department, which is problematic for promoting tourism because they see Popayán as a great product, but they don't really look outside the city boundaries.
The Popayán I visited last year for the first time, and it has, while my town of Mompós is incredibly run down and far away, Popayán has its links, but they have the same issue of, I think I can say it more frankly, the elitism of the white upper class who are of direct Spanish descent. The sort of people who have their family tree on the wall as you walk in, and they can prove to you how they you know, chart back to the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria and who was on Columbus's first journey, etc.
I mean, it's fine for them, it's great. The problem is, from a touristic point of view, the majority of tourists aren't that interested in that. They come from Europe, they come from North America, they come from places with a lot of history. So, you know, there are these things in Cauca which they don't have, which is indigenous culture, a strong indigenous culture, which they're not pushing. Because, for example, in Popayán, there's several museums dedicated to long-dead poets from from the town, but there's no museum about the indigenous groups of the department. There's nowhere you can go and find out about the different indigenous groups, their traditions, their culture. There's no place where you can even go and find out about the history of the town itself. It's every family having their own museum, which, you know, for them is great. It's keeping the culture alive. I'm all for it. But at the same time, there needs to be a focus to attract tourists on a much bigger picture.
And then, of course, nearby you have the market in Silvia, up the mountain a little ways, which is fascinating. I mean,
sure.
It's one of the things I did.
Silvia's great. I mean, the indigenous community, that they don't actually live in Silvia. They come down from the mountains to go to market day, which is Tuesday. It's great. Tourists should try to be a little discreet because they, you know, it's not great to go there and treat it like a zoo. It's people going about their daily lives. You know, by all means, go and mingle and, you know, maybe buy a poncho or, you know, eat a trout. But it's people in their everyday lives. It's not a, you know, it's not a tourist spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
So just, but it's definitely worth going. And the surrounding area around Silvia is beautiful. You can ride horses up to some lagoons. All these areas have amazing nature that, you know, is just beginning to be explored. As the security situation improves.
Yeah, this is very interesting. Well, we've been talking about with Alex Edgerton here, the Australian author of The Lonely Planet Guide to Colombia. We're going to take a short break, but it's a real pleasure to have him on the show, and we're going to start talking in the next segment. We'll start talking about sort of the business of guidebooks and the business of how to go about researching your holidays, your vacations, your travel plans. I mean, because it's an important issue these days. You know, there's so much information out there. So, of course, between myself and Alex, being authors and journalists and travelers, you know, I think we've got we can have a good consensus and a good sort of a back and forth about what needs to be done. So anyway, you're listening to Colombia Calling, and I'm talking to Alex Edgerton of The Lonely Planet, and don't go away, we'll be right back.
Pack your bags and explore the world with us. You're listening to the Overseas Radio Network.
This is Kathleen Petticord and Leif Simon with the Live and Invest Overseas Minute on the Overseas Radio Network. In the current climate, it's increasingly difficult for an American to open a bank account in a foreign country.
Even as a foreign resident looking to open a local operating account, in most countries it's going to take time and effort. A corporate account is going to be a little bit tougher, and a private investment bank account for your investment dollars is going to be virtually impossible in some countries, especially Switzerland.
Anywhere in the world you want to open an account as a foreigner, you're going to be required to produce a portfolio of documentation. This is a much more complicated process than in the United States.
The key things you're going to need, of course, are identity. You'll have a copy of your passport, a second identity, your driver's license will normally work for that, and you're going to need two banking reference letters from current banks, whether that's in the U.S. or elsewhere, and then you'll also need typically an introduction letter from an accountant or an attorney.
For more information on making the leap overseas, visit us online at liveandinvestoverseas.com.
You're tuned in to OverseasRadio.com, the station to help you reach your dream destination.
And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall, and we're sitting here in a tea house in Bogota talking to Alex Edgerton, who's the Lonely Planet author for Columbia. We're going to start this segment talking about sort of guidebooks and, you know, the wretched TripAdvisor, and it was, as a hotel owner, it's the bane of my existence. But I want to start with an anecdote because, I mean, it's just amusing. I had some American guests, North American guests, come down and stay in Mompox. Mompox is notoriously hot. There's not one guidebook out there that, you know, fails to mention this fact. I mean, I think the Footprint says it's soporifically hot. I think the Lonely Planet says something else, but equally, you know, equally extreme. But anyway, these Americans then wrote me an email saying, you know, if we'd only known how hot it was. And I just, you know, at what point did you just decide to pick this place off a map, or did you not do any research? Because to come to Colombia, it's not your first long-term destination. Most people have been to Mexico or Peru, and then they maybe look at Colombia or other countries, you know. And that's the thing, this is, sometimes it beggars belief. My mind boggles when people sort of write a complaint. It's like, oh, it was so hot, it was a bit dusty, oh, and there were mosquitoes. Well, you know, I just want to say, sweetheart, you're in the tropics, you know, and you're in Colombia. But anyway, I won't go into that anymore. It's just something, an anecdote off the top of my head. But, you know, look, guidebooks. What were you, as an author of a guidebook? I've written a couple as well. What's the future? What do we see happening?
Well, I think there's a very definite future there. Going back to your anecdote, that's exactly the point. Going into TripAdvisor or some other thing might tell you about hotels or restaurants, but it doesn't tell you where to go. Mm-hmm. It doesn't tell you why to go there. You know, I haven't found any very useful information on actually planning where you're going to go in something like TripAdvisor. I think it definitely has its purpose, you know. Yeah. It's a good thing to give people the voice to talk about, you know, hotels and restaurants. But when you're thinking, okay, I'm going to go to Colombia, what interests me there?
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to find that information? And that's where the guidebook comes in. Maybe, you know, whether it's in a printed form or in an ebook or an app or whatever it is, there is always going to be a market for, you know, professional critical advice. Because the job of a guidebook author is not to tell you what's the best thing. The job of a guidebook author, in my opinion, is to connect you with what interests you, you know, to make sure that you find the things that are interesting for you in your trip. And, for example, if they didn't like hot weather, if they had bought a guidebook, they might have decided to go to the Eje Cafetera, which has, you know, a very pleasant climate, maybe things that it's not very dusty, you know, and they could have spent their time and then got on their TripAdvisor or whatever. But yeah, the whole concept of planning your trip, for me, I would always buy a guidebook way before I left. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people don't open until they get there, but for me, the whole point to make the most, if you've got a short trip, is to go through and read what the areas have to offer, the attractions, mm-hmm. and then if you want to get into even more detail, you can get online. I think one of the major problems now is there's so much information online,
mm-hmm.
that people spend days and days and days and days planning their trips. Often they spend more days planning a destination, a city, mm-hmm. than actually spending in the city. You know, you even looking at hotels, there's 200 hotels on TripAdvisor. You begin looking through it, you know. Sometimes you just want to get there and know a place is quality,
sure.
you know.
Sure.
And, you know, if you find a guidebook brand, whichever it is, that you trust, that you've worked well with, then you go with that and you know you can more or less trust their recommendations. Obviously, there's always some places that appeal more to some people than others and there's different tastes. But like I said, the idea is that the guidebook author will enable you to narrow down your destinations, sure. your hotels, the neighborhood that you're going to stay in, to the places that interest you best. For example, even, you know, even in Bogota. Bogota is a huge place. If you choose the wrong neighborhood, you're going to spend your whole visit on buses or taxis traveling out of that neighborhood. Yeah. So, you know, it's an example of, you know, I think there will always be a place for that professional advice. I think if we want to talk a little bit about TripAdvisor and those kind of pages, there's a few problems developing now that people have adopted it on a massive level. When it first came out, I thought it was great, you know, giving people the chance to, you know, give their feedback in real time. And now, you know, the first problem is, I think if you look at TripAdvisor, it's popular choice, you know, but most people, me personally, I don't want to travel to the most popular place. I want to travel to the place that offers me the best experience for me. It's the same. If you purchased your music according to what was top of the charts, you'd have a pretty rubbish collection. You know, you'd have a lot of Britney Spears, you'd have a lot of all kinds of crap.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it's the same with travel. Why would I want to go where everybody wants to go? I want to go to a place that inspires me. And so the whole concept of being the best, for me, travel's not about the best.
Mm-hmm.
Travel's not about a competition, it's not about awards. It's about finding the experiences right for you. And I think even with this, with like categorizing things as the best by popular choice, is also TripAdvisor. People have often criticized guidebooks for like channeling tourists to particular places, but TripAdvisor and websites like that are doing that on a much, much greater level than guidebooks have ever done. You know, number one, guaranteed.
Yeah.
It's going to be full.
And of course, they can pay for the premium service.
Of course, this is a problem. This is the next problem, is that the actual ranking system, for me, is, as a journalist, is quite a problem. You know, Google has really complex algorithms that works fantastically. You put something in Google and they know what you're looking for and it comes up. With TripAdvisor, somebody who has one or two reviews, their review is given the same weight as somebody who has 200 reviews, who's obviously got a lot more experience to evaluate. I don't understand why they can't come up with an algorithm that, you know, weights according to the experience and the regions that someone's traveling. They don't seem very interested in that, because you often see a place, you know, with these people that have had one review in one city, and it elevates the place up the charts. The other question is whether those reviews are legitimate. There's a lot of, you know, reviews on there. I know personally hotel owners who sit and write bad reviews about their competition and write great reviews about themselves. They either do that directly themselves, or they give people beers, or they give incentives to write reviews about their place. I mean, it's become business. And that's the difference. With a good guidebook, the owner of the hotel really has no recourse. If the author likes the place, they like it, they include it. If not, they're not. I know at Lonely Planet we don't take any payment from anybody. You know, the only way to get in is to be a good product. And that's why, you know, especially with other guidebooks, that's why you can trust your guidebook author more than, you know, somebody who has the potential to warp the rankings. And the other thing is, with TripAdvisor, they have now introducing services where hotels can pay a premium to become, to have a more visible listing, which, you know, defeats the purpose of being a user system. If the hotels now can, you know, place themselves above the other hotels that have just as good ratings, by paying more money, then it's just another, you know.
So it's, I mean, the brand which has more cash in its pocket to spend is going to, you know, compete, let's say, on a less even playing field from those who don't.
Of course, and it's not just, it's money, but it's also its technological awareness. Your mom and pop place, you know, in some small town in the Medio Magdalena, don't have the technological, you know how. Or the funds to compete with these guys who spend their whole day on TripAdvisor, yet those are the guys that are offering a real, authentic Colombian experience. And so, and I guess lastly as well, the other thing about it is, when you have sites that become so powerful, like people criticize the guidebook, but with TripAdvisor and that kind of thing, the problem is it really takes a little bit of the discovery out, because those good places get booked out way in advance. There's no, you know, so people are booking their hotel, okay, I'm going to spend 2 days in Montpos, 4 days in Santa Marta. But if you get to a place and you like it, you've already got all your reservations for your whole trip. So, you know, it becomes hard with all these places becoming booked out in advance, everybody planning everything online. It takes a little bit of the romanticism out of traveling, because everything's prearranged. You have so many days in so-and-so place, but until you get there, you don't know.
Yeah, I mean, but that's a big difference between traveling and then a holiday as well. It's because if you've only got the 2 weeks, and then I'm getting people, emails in January of people saying, you know, trying to book for December. You know, they're coming from the UK and they've only got 2 days, etc., etc. And I'm just like, listen, I'm not sure I want to take your booking this far ahead of time, because at the moment I'm going to put it, if I put it in my system and then, you know, 3 weeks beforehand you decide not to come. It's been sitting there all year, and it's like, I prefer not to have things up until the 6th.
Of course, and it's also, it's you know, you could get there and it could be stinging hot more than usual in Mompos, and you could decide you want it, or it could be beautiful and you want to spend more time. And once you have everything locked in, you know, if you just get off a bus, you end up in the crummy hotels because everything's booked out now. And it's the same, there's another site that's quite popular. I mean, I don't mean to pick on just TripAdvisor.
Right.
Hostel World. But I know of places where people have written bad reviews and have been taken down. And, you know, if you present yourself as giving the user voice, but you're really working for the companies, then your legitimacy evaporates. I know a certain chain of hostels that I won't mention that have a lot of hostels. They got some bad reviews. I know people have written bad reviews, and they threatened to pull out of the system because they receive money, Hostel World, with reservations. They threatened to pull out, and then suddenly all their bad reviews disappeared.
Apparently Hostel World are going through economic problems at the moment. And so they've increased their... I'm not on Hostel World, but they've increased their commission from 10% to 12% this year.
They claim that, Richard, but they also just bought one of their competitors in a highly expensive deal. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that... You know, that's the inside workings of their business. I'm not sure, but I'll take that with a grain of salt.
Who did they buy?
Hostel Bookers, I believe.
Oh, really?
I'm not sure if it's... I believe it's Hostel Bookers.
Well, then, of course, you can always look at Virtual Tourist. And, I mean, there's however many. There's Trip Wolf as well, which I don't think is huge, but I don't know. I mean, there's any number of them out there, really. And that is... The information is there. It's about having to say something like, you as a writer, myself as a writer, and we can see through the falsities right away. But maybe other people can't. You know, maybe not. You know, people who aren't conditioned to it cannot. So it's a challenge always, isn't it? I mean, but you know, what advice would you? What, I mean, in a phrase, is there something, some advice that you would give someone who's considering coming to Colombia? What would you say aside from promoting the Lonely Planet? What would you say? Listen, this is what you need to read.
Well, I think before you leave, there's absolutely no harm in, you know, getting online and finding the kind of destinations, you know, you want. But, you know, Google's your friend.
Yeah.
You know, don't just stick to the mainstream, you know, portals, because there's so much information. If you speak Spanish, even more so. Mm. The thing about Colombia that's a challenge is that the culture of independent tourism doesn't really exist here.
Mm-hmm.
It's slowly getting developed with a lot of help from foreign visitors, because the vast majority of Colombian travelers in the past, and understandably so, didn't travel much around their own country because of security issues. Basically, the majority of this was security issues.
Yeah.
And now, because of that, the concept of traveling is more like package tourism, where you pay, you get taken, you get given your food, your hotels, everything is organized for you.
So you feel more secure.
More secure because somebody's looking after it. So therefore, if you ask your Colombian friends how to go to some place or another place, there are some amazing travelers. Herman Escobar, the owner of Casa Platypus, is a legend in Bogota.
Because he says el abuelo de los mochileros.
Yeah, I mean, there are some Colombian travelers there who have an absolutely amazing...
Oscar, of course, would be the labor, Renacer, and everything. So, yeah.
But in general, it's something that's quite hard to tap into. That institutional knowledge that maybe in other countries has developed over a long period of time is just beginning to develop. So, you know, there's a lot of forums. I mean, without meaning to promote Lonely Planet, the Thorn Tree Forum, which they've incidentally just relaunched. It's quite a useful resource, you know, about from other travelers who have beaten the track. And also, you know, buy a couple of guidebooks, read through them. It's a small investment compared to how much you're going to spend in the country. You know, if you're talking $25, $30, buy a couple of books to identify the areas you want to go.
Well, very interesting. We're going to come back in the next segment and talk a bit more about the security situation, because we've just started touching on that and on that issue. And of course, it's key towards any travel in Colombia. So we're talking to Alex Edgerton, an expert in the region, Lonely Planet author, and it's a real pleasure to have him on the show. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. Please don't go away.
Your expatriation destination. This is OverseasRadio.com.
Worried about rising taxes, costly insurance, out-of-control health care, economic decline, staggering debt, mortgages, and retirement? It doesn't have to be this way. Escape to Ecuador, one of the most beautiful countries on the planet, and at EcuadorAtYourService.com, be your guide. Ecuador has been named the number one retirement destination in the world 3 times in a row. So if you're searching for beaches, jungles, farmland, cities, affordable health care, and a richer lifestyle at half the cost, contact EcuadorAtYourService.com.
Sit back and relax. You are tuned into the Overseas Radio Network.
And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. We're talking to Alex Edgerton of The Lonely Planet, Columbia, author of many guidebooks to the region. Anyway, we've been talking about really interesting situations, you know, regarding the evolution of let's see, the travel information industry, really. But we're going to touch on something that's, of course, of key importance here in Colombia when we, you know, when anyone's thinking of coming to Colombia, it's the security situation. Now, Alex, you recently have been off into the wilds. You were off into a department, as states are called here, called, you know, Mitú and Valpes. The Mitú is the capital. And, I mean, this is out there. I mean, they probably get 15 tourists a year or something. regarding security, what was your experience out there? I mean,
well, to be honest, the area around Valpes in particular is actually not too bad now because there's not a lot of money floating around there. Security problems in Colombia tend to gravitate to places where there is money, whether that's with cattle ranches, mining, industry, business. So Valpes is mostly populated by indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. There's not really much cattle ranching. There's not really yet much mining, although that could change. As far as armed groups in a department, right now, it's not too bad. Obviously, it's dense jungle. The whole department is probably one of the most covered in jungle in Colombia. It was cut off as a department to be initially to protect some of that jungle in that area to keep it away from the agricultural frontier and the. But I mean, obviously, those kind of geographical situations pay themselves to harbour in armed groups, but there's really not much there to sustain them. If you come further closer to Bogota, you'll find a lot more, you know, in Guaviare and other departments, Caqueta. But having said that, it's famous. Mitú was taken by the guerrilla, I believe, in 98, which was the Toma de Mitú, when they the FARC arrived by river and took over the capital of the department, which is almost unheard of, to take over a departmental capital. They held it for a couple of days and then marched a lot of hostages off into the jungle. So it's still got that stigma in Colombia. And, you know, the institutions, I always say that when you get to a new place in Colombia, you can gauge a little bit of security situation by the demeanor of the security forces, the police and the military. You know, in general, they're very pleasant all over Colombia when dealing with tourists. But you can sometimes they're a bit more terse, a bit more, you know, stressed.
Yeah.
And that's when you should worry a little bit more. In Mitú, everybody was very relaxed, which, you know, gives you a bit of security. You feel that, you know, when people are dodging bullets every day, they tend to be a little bit more irritable. So they're, no, and it's also, it's very heavily militarized right now. Sure. There's, apparently, I was told while I was there, 4,000 police and military in Mitú. And there's a population of 6,000.
That's right.
So, you know, it's one military for every 1.5
residents. So a town of bars and brothels.
Yeah, well, it's a frontier town. I mean, the military, they keep in pretty tight check because I've heard that it's a strategic part of the country that the government's looking to neutralise and stabilise. But the town itself, there's a lot of characters there who arrived before there was any military presence. You know, going back 30 years, there was no state presence at all. It was an outpost. It was founded as a rubber outpost when in the days that they were desperately looking for rubber during World War II. And then after that was the coca boom, and people moved in and planted massive plantations, cut out the jungle, planted massive plantations of coca. That's been reduced a great deal there now. It's too far, it's too remote. It's now there's too much, you know, spotlight. But a lot of those guys stuck around. A lot of these, you know, characters who came and now, you know, now have businesses in town. You know, but it's got that frontier feel. But security, definitely, it's probably one of the most secure places I've been in Colombia.
Now, all of these characters, they all had gold teeth and chains. And
yeah, you know the usual gold teeth, chains, beers for breakfast, kind of hard. I mean, even the guys that fly the planes, that they to get out there, you can fly with Satena in a nice modern plane, or you can take a DC-3, you know, an 80-year-old plane out there.
Dakotas from World War II.
Which are great. Yeah. I mean, you're sitting there in this bunch of metal and bolts with, you know, with drums of gasoline strapped in front of you. You know, but the guys that fly those planes are real characters.
They've been the bus services of the jungle.
Yeah, no, they're amazing. I mean, everything that you eat in Mitú, comes in on those plains. Everything you drink comes in on those plains. There's no road. There's a river that takes 16 days to get to a place called Calamar, which is still far from Bogota. Some people bring things by the river, but the river route is problematic with security. They have to pay taxes to the armed groups.
Sure.
And, you know, sure. So most things come in on these old plains, and it's definitely, I mean, it's not your classic tourist destination, no. But it's interesting.
So, moving on a little bit, if you were talking to a novice or someone who's coming to Colombia, where would they find out beforehand about the security situation?
That's the real issue, Richard. Yeah. There is very little accurate, impartial information out there. Everybody has an agenda to push. You know, the government had a campaign which was that Colombia, the only risk is you want to stay.
Mm-hmm.
I understand the need for such a campaign because Colombia has a real bad reputation around the world, and you know, to paint a picture of the progress, it served the purpose, but it's also a little bit misleading because there are still places as a tourist you can't go and you shouldn't be going.
Uh-huh.
The problem is, how do you find those places out? If you ask a lot of Colombian friends, they might have outdated views based on historical events, like
sure.
the Toma of Mitu or certain towns like Cauca, Popayan. If you ask many people in Bogota, they say, don't go to Popayan. It's dangerous. It's, you know, a guerrilla haven, which is couldn't be further from the truth. The town itself is fine. So where do you get the information? Unfortunately, there's very little out there. Guidebooks get dated very fast. You know, you research your book, maybe a town is fine, and then the security situation changes. And the other problem is it's not a black and white thing. It's not just groups like the FARC. There's so many different groups, criminal gangs operating. Some are very politically involved, some aren't. But it's very hard, you know, in different areas. One could be in control and then another could be in control in a short space of time. For example, the areas around Tumaco, Buenaventura, which are culturally very interesting, and the Litoral of Cauca have, Afro-descendant populations, great dance and music and a lot of culture, but very difficult to travel right now.
Yeah.
But as a tourist, it's very difficult. These forums are very important, asking other travelers. Local hostels should be able to tell you when you arrive as a base, you know, the surrounding area. Most capital cities in Colombia are fine, but before you get off the track, you should definitely be asking around. There's been a number of instances recently of people, you know, of tourists actually being kidnapped or even killed. We can't ignore the fact. It's unlikely. The vast majority of people to Colombia are unlikely to have any problem at all. But you need to make yourself aware that if you really want to get off the beaten track, that, you know, you need to look for information. Email people, email the owners of a hostel before you go. Say, look, if you want to go, let's say, through the Amazon, you know, find the owners of a hostel in Leticia and ask them, how is the area? How's the situation? Because they're the people on the ground who can give you the best, most up-to-date information.
And, of course, they're the ones who are going to suffer if anything happens as well.
Of course.
So it's in their best interest to tell you the truth.
Of course. It's a blanket, everything's fine, is not in the best interest of everybody, because then if something happens, it's the worst possible publicity for the country. I mean, as a traveller, there's not really any one point of call. You should, you know, a lot of places when you arrive in a town, the military will take you aside and, you know, they'll tell you that things are difficult. Sometimes they'll make you sign a paper saying that you're going at your own risk. This happened to us a lot in the Amazon region. They're trying to, you know, secure that you know what's going on. And then they're not going to stop you going somewhere, but you will be doing it at your own risk. The problem is that the information is often a lot contradictory. The authorities in Colombia don't always share information. You know, when we were in Mitu, the military stopped us on the river and said, you can't go further south without a permit.
Mm-hmm.
We were trying to leave the town, and they said, you can't leave because, you know, there's security problems. You have to go back and talk to the police and get a permit. So we motored back up the river using more gasoline,
yeah.
Got to the police, and the police said, no, you can go anywhere you want. You're free to go wherever you like. This is, you know, safe area. So we went back down to the military spot and they said, okay, then we're going to get you to sign a paper. But there's no coordination. There's a tourist police force in Colombia, but they should probably be putting a bit more attention into, you know, at least there's some areas of the country where tourism shouldn't be being promoted.
Yeah.
And they should, you know, be conscious of that, because like you said, the worst thing is for something to happen. That's the worst possible publicity. And there's so many safe places you can go.
Yeah.
That, you know, it would be really helpful for there to be a portal for people to find out information. But I think they're a little bit concerned about scaring people away,
of course.
Which is natural. But at the same time, like we said, the best policy is honesty. And I think as tourism develops, people want to get away from the the main track, because, you know, now there's a significant number of foreign tourists in Colombia. So, you know, your adventure-minded backpacker is obviously now looking to branch out a little further to get new experiences. And so for these people, right now they're really dependent on other travellers. And you know, the small percentage of Colombians that do travel outside their realm of comfort.
So in this sort of circumstance, we're saying that, you know, again, and it comes up a lot on this show, so Colombia is running before it can walk a little bit, in terms of it's trying to make give the impression that we're as diverse and as developed as Mexico, but without that infrastructure and that know-how, let's say. And then so people can come here and get the wrong end of the stick, or, you know, be disappointed as well.
Of course. I think there's a huge difference between the image that the government is trying to push and the reality in a lot of places. I mean, you know, you see some of the publicity, which is expensive publicity and you know, big campaigns to bring people to Colombia, but it's really all slogans,
yeah.
You know, without actually investing, because tourism is something, Colombia has a massive opportunity to develop tourism in a sustainable and positive way. It's been held back by the conflict, by its reputation for a long time. What does that mean? That means they can learn from all their neighbours how to develop tourism in a way that benefits people, that doesn't, you know, concentrate money in the hands of a few, and they have a huge possibility to do this, but it really takes investment in the sector. It's not just about slogans. It's not just about, you know, pretty publicity. It's about getting in there, training people, you know, capacitating people, going in these communities. Because if they don't do that, what happens is the capital comes from outside. They develop hotels, all-inclusive resorts. But the local people who might be, you know, maybe inclined to join an armed group, because there's no jobs, instead of getting involved in tourism and seeing that it benefits them, they've been isolated, and happens in a lot of remote places. I think it's a real issue that needs to be addressed urgently, because the best way to maintain safety in a place is to have people mingling with the locals. Those are the ones that, you know, they will maintain your personal safety. Most of the communities, for example, around Cauca, where I live, if you go with somebody from that community, a resident, you'll never have a problem. You know, if you're invited in, you know, to go and explore and to go to their house, and it's people jumping off a bus in the middle of nowhere that will have a problem. And that's why it's key that there is resources put to capacitating people in these communities to identifying areas that are appealing to foreigners, and making an effort that the locals benefit from the development of tourism in those places.
So what would you say then to those thrill seekers or potential thrill seekers out there, you know, if they wanted to go off the beaten track? What would your advice be?
Well, I know we differ a little bit on this, Richard, because I believe, you know, I'm very much all about independent travel, and some of your best experiences are off the beaten track. There is a risk.
Yeah.
I think if you know the risk and are prepared to take it, well, that's your choice. There's a risk in everything. There's people that like to jump out of aeroplanes with parachutes. For me, you know, your greater risk in Colombia is probably your bus going off the edge of a mountain than being, you know, kidnapped or you know, that kind of risk is a risk there. It's about knowing it and managing it. Of course, if you want to go to the out-of-the-way destinations, you have to be prepared. You know, I'm not saying don't go. I think I'm all for going. Go explore. Because I think until you open up these areas, they never will resolve the issues. So, but I think you need to be prepared. You need to, you know, talk with local people. There was a case of an American, a former soldier, who was kidnapped in Guaviare.
Yeah, Kevin Scott Sute.
Yeah, recently. And all the local people in San Jose de Guaviare told him not to go on that route, that he was guaranteed that he'd be kidnapped. You know, he ignored that advice and was kidnapped. I mean, that's the situation. If you want to go, there's plenty of places you can go into the jungle without being kidnapped. Just listen to what people are telling you. But, you know, there's no reason not to go. Like we said, the situation is fluid. If you painted a red swathe through all the places where something could happen, you'd be restricted to your hotel room.
Yeah.
It's a matter of keeping up to date and taking, you know, the necessary precautions. If, for example, this guy didn't even speak any Spanish, so, you know, it's very difficult to explain what you're doing in a place when you can't speak the language. You know, if you're getting kidnapped and somebody's, what are you doing here? Maybe if he could speak good Spanish and explain, they would have let him go. You know, there's certain things you can do. Obviously, before coming to Colombia, it's a place where the tourism infrastructure is still limited. Learning at least a little bit of Spanish will help you greatly if you're somebody that really wants to get off the path.
Right. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you, Alex. Thank you for your time and your knowledge, sharing it with us. Now, quick fire questions. Let's say right at the end here, just to wind this down, because obviously you're a travel writer. There's billions of people out there who want to be travel writers. How did you get into the business, and what advice would you give to any budding travel writer out there, apart from don't do it?
Yeah, well, I was going to say it's not as romantic as it sounds. You know, when you're in a dusty bus stations in provincial towns, having to write down every time, and nobody seems to know what time what bus goes to what place, and when, you know, you're looking under toilet seats and under mattresses, and you know, it's not as romantic as it sounds, Richard. But it is a great job, especially in regards with having the ability to open up new destinations and to help projects and areas that are really doing positive things. That's, for me, that's the best part of it, is, you know, have that little bit of influence. You know, if you see a great project that's involving, you know, young people and promoting tourism in a sustainable way, being able to direct people there rather than to, you know, something that was maybe less positive. To get in, it's all about, you know, your knowledge. Local knowledge is king. Mm-hmm. You know, being able to demonstrate that you know that, and that your ability to communicate. Like I was saying to you before, for me, the key role of a travel writer is not to say what's best, mm-hmm. is to connect people to what they're looking for. Mm-hmm. So there's two real things. I mean, ability to communicate and you know, local knowledge, and also just you've got to be prepared for long, hard days. I mean, when you're on the road, we get up at 7 a.m, start checking out breakfast places. And you go check out the attractions, lunch places. You finish in the night, you go into bars, but you can never stay in one bar. You find a great bar, you can, you know, maybe have a beer, then you've got to move on to the next. You've got to do 6-7 bars in a night. So it's perseverance. It's a lot of research. It's for every, you know, page in a town, maybe you've spent 3 days researching it. And so if you really want to get in, I think it's important that, you know, you find a place that you love and that you can write about with passion, because that kind of local knowledge is what people are looking for, that insight. And a lot of guidebook companies every now and again are looking for people. You just have to get lucky as well. I mean, if they already have authors in your area, maybe it's a bit tough, but you've just got to keep plugging away and you know, keep presenting yourself. And when the need arises, well, you never know. You might get the call up.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And some wise words from Alex there is that, you know, you've got to have a good drinking capacity to be a travel writer.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so you've been listening to Alex Edgerton talking about his experiences as a travel writer. I'm Richard McCall. Thank you for listening. This is Columbia Calling. Please send us some feedback and we'll keep the shows coming.
Live call-in shows and hosts from your favorite countries. This is the Overseas Radio Network.